We had a good number of connections for Bible Study Wednesday. I appreciated that very much. Wasn't sure with the still, you know, early sunshine and late sunset and how much it would be, but we had, I think, about 47 hookups during Bible study and over 100 2 days later. So we are still thankful to have a good audience and number of people that are viewing the Bible study. This week it will be the turn of Tacoma to do theirs. We're going to be alternating every week. And certainly hope that we get all of the Bible studies in on the Wednesdays that we can between now and May. Most of you are familiar with the beginning of the book of Psalms. Psalm 1 is simply a summary of mankind's experience. It's a summary of the life of man. Psalm 2 is a summary of the nations of the earth. And it's important when you read those two psalms that you understand the nature of why God begins the book of Psalms in this way. Psalm 1 is simply the summary of every one of our lives. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the paths of sinners. We do live in a society of ungodly and sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. We'll read about some of those scorners in a few minutes. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth in its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not prosper. Whatever he does, not wither. Whatever he does shall prosper. But the ungodly are not so. So there are only two paths, the righteous and the ungodly. The book of Revelation ends with the same subject. Those who are ungodly go into the lake of fire, those who have walked in the way of righteousness into the kingdom of God or into New Jerusalem. So the ungodly are not so, but are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Where do they stand? Well, they stand in the resurrection. But they shall not be there. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. There are only two choices. Jesus Christ said, narrow is the way to life. If you be there, find it. Wide is the way to destruction. That's a fairly simple psalm. We could make lots of personal lessons, take a lot of personal lessons off of Psalm 1. But since we are heading into the Feast of Tabernacles time, I was thinking, what is a good psalm to introduce the purpose of the Feast of Tabernacles and the fall holy day season? And I think there's nothing better than the second psalm, because the second psalm is a summary of the experience of the nations of the earth. There's a biblical example in the book of Daniel, but first I want to just start Psalm chapter 2, and I would suggest you put a marker there of some kind in Psalm 2, because we're going to come back and forth to it several times. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? All down the 6,000 years of mankind's history, ever since Cain went out and built himself a city, the kings of the earth have taken counsel together against God. We have very, very few nations in history that have actually tried to submit to God as they were formed. Perhaps ancient Israel in ancient times, for at least for some of their years, and for a little while perhaps the United States of America when we were first founded, when many of our leaders did publicly submit their will to God. But overall, the nations have followed this path. Now, the path was set by the very first world ruler. Let's go to Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. This is a summary of what we would call the religion of humanism, which has become the national religion of our time. It's a philosophy, a way of looking at people, particularly ourselves, apart from God, which is not right, obviously, and is very harmful, but instead of looking at people as creatures made in the image of God, whom we should love as God loved us, humanism looks at man as the center of everything. So the humanistic society which we live in, and the religion, you might say, that has overwhelmed this nation, overwhelmed the formerly Christian nations, the religion of humanism basically looks at man at the center of everything. So it is a perfectly secular point of view. So we use the word secular humanism, although the two words pretty much mean the same thing. An example of humanism is in the book of Daniel here in chapter 4. And of course, you're familiar with this. The king had a dream, and of course, the dream had this statue, made this statue. But King Nebuchadnezzar began to think that because he was now the ruler of all the nations of the earth that were known at that time, that he became full of himself. It was almost like Narcissus looking at his view in the mirror. Verse 28 of Daniel chapter 4 says, "At this time, King Nebuchadnezzar, at the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon." So here we have, after Daniel had interpreted the dream and told him he was the first of these world-ruling governors, it took him a year of ruminating on it to think about how wonderful he was and how great he was and all the great things he'd accomplished. So he's walking out in the royal palace of Babylon, and the king spoke. He didn't just think these things. He spoke them out loud to the audience that could hear him. And he probably had a large entourage of followers and helpers and some of his officers and various people. So the king spoke, saying, "Is this not great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and the honor of my majesty?" So true of the rulers of this world down through time. They believe it's all about their majesty, especially in the world ruling in the Gentile nations, where we have had time after time after time and still have it occurring, where their picture is constantly posted on billboards, on the sides of buildings. It's well known that when the American soldiers went into Baghdad in Iraq back in the 2000s, that Saddam Hussein had a law that on every street corner, at least three buildings had to have a large mural of Saddam Hussein. So no matter where you went in Baghdad, you had three of his faces looking down at you. It's kind of like going to Seattle and Starbucks. Every corner you've got three Starbucks looking, well, very similar. There are actually a couple intersections up there where there are three Starbucks on out of the four corners. But the same thing happens today. We still have dictators that come on the scene and they want their picture everywhere, and certainly very, very common over in the Far East. But here, Babylon was great, but it wasn't great by Nebuchadnezzar's power, even though he thought it was. But while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, for to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you." So we are to do everything to the glory of God, but instead King Nebuchadnezzar thought it was all for the glory of self. And certainly we have seen that repeated time and time and time again down through history. And in this heated and thoroughly charged up election season that we are in, as are about 50 other nations around the earth, we see these same false values of humanism and the glory of man once again rearing their ugly head. We have been in a time when we are similar to a prophetic experience that has been before. Now, one of the great lessons of Ecclesiastes is that human experience will be repeated. He said there's nothing new under the sun, that what has been will be again. It isn't just there to fill up space in the Bible or to say something that sounds good you can think about. It really is true. When God is telling us, learn some lessons from history. And it is sad that our modern education system has neglected history so much in recent years. I want to go back to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. And as you know, this is the time or the account of the flood. And of course, what happened to mankind just prior to that? There are those who today are, I think, honestly, archaeologists that are trying to find the ark or feel they have found it. Who knows exactly? I've heard a lot of reports. Mr. Siegley knows a lot more about that than I do. But I know for many, many years, people have been trying to find Noah's Ark. Jimmy Carter said he saw it flying over the mountains of Turkey back when he was president, because apparently the ice had receded. And it's in his memoirs. He said, "Yeah, we all pointed out the window and said, yeah, we saw half of an ark sticking out of the ice." So it may very well be there, or remnants of it may be there. But at any rate, the important thing for us is that whether or not there's a boat over on a mountain in Ararat or in Turkey. What's important is that we are repeating the experience of Genesis 6. We are repeating the experience of God being kicked out, the nations making plans in vain, and then God laughing at them in derision and bringing judgment. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 1, "It became to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful and took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. The Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for indeed he is flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. So very likely he's talking about the righteous lineage from Seth down to Noah, and some of those began to have a relationship they should not have had with some of the descendants of Cain, but that's a subject for a different time. The Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, showing it was men doing this, not demons, not Satan the devil. Man is the one who chose to be degenerate, chose to have a society based on evil and violence. For he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. So from the time that God began to warn mankind about their impending doom, their impending punishment, it was 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and bore children to them, these were the mighty men of old, men of renown. So there were men who organized cities. They were men after the example of Nimrod, who began to organize cities later. But we have here men dominating other people and becoming as Nebuchadnezzar was, saying, look at all these great things that I have done, these cities I have built. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was very great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This is an important verse, because combined with a number of other verses where God warns people about the sins of the Amorites not coming to the full, and a few other places, God does allow, if there is a slight chance in that person's heart that he could repent, God allows time for that. Now, sadly, the march of evil continues, and people who are evil that evil simply grows. It's not replaced by good unless genuine repentance is brought to bear, and there are not many accounts of that. So we have the thoughts of man's heart becoming evil continually. If you look at the progression of evil in our nation, and we could look at the beginnings of some of the evil in our society, some of the degradation of morality in society, you can go back to the laws that were passed allowing 1973, allowing abortion legally, the murder of innocent little children in their mother's womb, or you could look at some of the other hallmark events, the events of the 1970s, late 60s, Woodstock and others, where basically the generation said, we don't want God's laws, we don't want any rules over our life, we want to do what we want to do. The Lord was sorry he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart because he saw there was no chance for repentance. There was no chance for going back to living the way they should. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created on the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. And basically what he's saying is it's just, you know, it's all gone bad with the evil influence of Satan the devil and the societies that men built. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So Noah was one who was very, very rare in that time, who was following God. Verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. So all flesh except for Noah. Jesus Christ, it would be like the days of Noah before the coming of the Son of Man, before he came back to the earth. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come to me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So Noah was in a time that Jesus Christ would quote later as completely violent. God simply said, there is no going back. There is simply a time of being punished. Now I want to go back to Psalm 2. So if you have your place marked there, if you can just turn back there quickly. Psalm 2 is very frequently quoted in the New Testament. 60% of these 12 verses are quoted in the New Testament. Probably percentage-wise, one of the longest or the most quoted verses in the New Testament from the Old. But it is called a messianic or a royal psalm, but basically it is a summary of the expressions or the conditions, the experience of mankind down through the years. Now, this was written by David. How do we know that? Well, let's just go over to Acts chapter 4 and verse 25. Acts chapter 4 and verse 25, where Peter is quoting this verse. Acts chapter 4 and verse 25, Peter says, who by the mouth of your servant David has said, why did the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. So here is being quoted, and he says very plainly, it is written by David. But he's simply talking about the fact that man's governments are resistive to God's laws. They simply don't want the laws of God to bother them. This book, let's go back to Psalm 2, but Psalm 2 is quoted in Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Hebrews, and twice in Revelation. And so it's a very important psalm as we begin to prepare for the Feast of Tabernacles. So Psalm 1, why are the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The nations certainly are raging, and they pass laws in tremendous defiance of God's laws. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. So they take counsel together. I don't know if this is a prophecy of the United Nations. I rather doubt if it is, but the concept is right. The rulers take counsel together, and they pass laws, rules, make agreements that are against God and against Jesus Christ, the Messiah who is coming. And they say, let us break their bonds in pieces, cast away their cords from us. Now, what are the bonds and what are the cords? Well, they are the laws of God. The nations don't like the laws of God. They don't like thou shalt not steal, or thou shalt not murder, or thou shalt not commit adultery. They don't like thou shalt not covet. So they have these bonds and cords that they say the anointed and the Lord have put over them. And they say, let's cast those away. And we see that happening throughout the Western world because the Eastern world's gotten rid of them pretty much generations ago. So what is the reaction here from God? He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. So while God is in heaven watching all these things, he laughs at those who are defiant against him. The Lord shall hold them in derision. To simply roll his eyes and wonder, how can such petty little creatures think they can defy me? He shall speak to them in his great wrath and his distress in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. In other words, God says, I am going to establish my son Jesus Christ ruling on the earth. And that is going to be the solution for all of man's problems. We celebrate that. We remind ourselves of it. We contemplate it during the Feast of Tabernacles, that Jesus Christ is going to be ruling on the earth, and all of those nations that have defied him, all of those leaders, are going to be broken and in despair. In fact, most of them will no longer be here. Verse 7 says, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Now, some interpretations of this would have this happening right after Jesus Christ ascended from the Mount of Olives in 31 AD, that he went back to heaven to sit down at the right hand of his Father. And he says of him, ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance. So the panorama of this psalm, you might say, takes place between the ascension of Jesus Christ and his return back to the earth to rule all nations. So I'm not 100% sure that all Bible commentators would agree on that, but I think it's a fairly reasonable understanding of it. It says, ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. And certainly that is something that we are anxious to have happen. It hasn't happened yet. But hold your place here. Let's go back to Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13. And in verse 33. Again, where it is quoted, here Paul is giving his message in Antioch, and he says, God has fulfilled this for us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second psalm. So Paul was very good at memorizing the psalms. You are my son, today I have begotten you. And he raised him from the dead, no more to return to corruption. Thus he has spoken, I will give you the sure mercies of David. And, of course, that's from Psalm 89. It's not from the second psalm. And verse 35, therefore, he also says in another psalm, you will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. And that is from Psalm chapter 16 and verse 10. So Paul is showing that Jesus Christ fulfilled these three prophetic psalms. And that when God the Father said, "Today you are my son, today I have begotten you," it was about the time when Jesus Christ was raised up and returned back to his Father in heaven. And while we're over there, let's also go to Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 5, where the same thing pretty much is quoted. But here we have Hebrews chapter 1, and most of you know this is simply eight prophetic psalms put in a chronological order to have the introduction to the book, to the life of Jesus Christ and his calling and his purpose. Verse 5 of Hebrews chapter 1, "For to which of the angels did he ever say, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you,' and again, 'I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son'?" Now that comes from 2 Samuel, but it's the only one, only quote in this verse that is not from the book of Psalms. So here we have the angels being left out. God the Father says to his son, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Now let's continue on down. God is being questioned in the times in which we live. We have all sorts of ideas out there about where man came from. When people look at the society around us and the fact that wrong has become right, where people think that if they take children and give them mind-altering chemicals and mutilate them, that somehow that will make the children happy, where they can, a woman who lives all of her life without ever bearing a child and only having a career somehow is happier than the woman who is staying home and taking care of a wonderful bunch of kids. The verse, "Why do the nations rage?" I think is one we have to think about. Psalm 2, verse 1, why are the nations rage? Why are they in such turmoil? It's interesting, the word for rage actually means a tumultuous ocean or water, a water that's full of waves and wind and rain, like a hurricane on the ocean. We live in a time when the nations are somewhat like that. There is a hurricane on the ocean, and people imagine a vain thing. So how do people come to the place where they imagine vain or worthless things? It's a good question for us to ask. If you look at the foundations of any society or any culture, it all goes back to their teachers, their heroes. Who were the foundational people, the foundational, you might say, thinkers or idea promoters? You go back to ancient Greece, you've got Thucydides, later Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and a number of others. In Rome, of course, you had the earlier Roman writers and eventually some of their historians. But who were the foundational, you might say, thought thinkers of the times in which we live? Or if someone asks you, who are the ones who are the foundational teachers of what is today the society of America, for that matter, Canada, Australia, New Zealand? Well, there are four prominent names. Actually, there are many more who followed in their ideas. But if I were to be asked who are the foundational thinkers of the times in which we live, the French, of course, could go back to Rousseau, Montesquieu, a number of others that were the thinkers that resulted in the French Revolution, which was godless, as opposed to the American Revolution, which was based on the principles in the scriptures. But why is evolution accepted, taught in our schools, and those who would teach against it or talk against it often ridiculed in public, made fun of? Well, the first philosopher that is a foundational teacher of the times in which we live was a man named Carl Sagan. He was born in 1934, died in 1996, did not live a long life, 62 years, I guess, 64. Carl Sagan was an American astronomer. Many of you might have seen the PBS specials that were done on Carl Sagan. And Carl Sagan was one who very, very strongly taught that there was no God, everything just simply happened by accident. Therefore, accidents must have happened in other places in the universe. And he was the foundational teacher of what is called SETI, S-E-T-I, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so we had movies like E.T. Now, what was interesting about E.T., you go back and look at that movie, it's kind of an interesting movie to go back now, 40 years ago, and watch E.T. But E.T. was kind, he was nice, he healed, he didn't want to hurt anybody. And so Carl Sagan's philosophy idea is that there must be societies out there where beings are perfect actually found its way into Hollywood, as opposed to like some of the Star Wars movies and things that got pretty bizarre. But Carl Sagan was the beginning of the extraterrestrial intelligence, you might say, gurus. He was originally a professor at Harvard. He later moved to Cornell. He wrote about 20 books and 600 scientific papers. But he was a popular advocate for simply disagreeing with everything, challenging modern mores and accepted truths and ways of doing things, and taking off on your own. Now, some of the ideas that he said obviously were good. He encouraged youngsters to get educated and to plow new territory and to think of thoughts that hadn't been thought before. And perhaps some of his ideas resulted in people like Steve Jobs. And what did Steve Jobs say his purpose in life was? Anybody know? Well, he went to college right over here at Reed College. In fact, when he died, he left them a very large amount of money, even though he was only there about a year and a half. But Steve Jobs said his purpose in life was to invent things people did not know they couldn't live without. That's why you have a cell phone, because it was an idea of his. Once you get one in your pocket, you won't be able to live without it. Now, how do you feel when you lose your cell phone for half a day? You're in a panic. In fact, most of us have these Apple Watches, so you can look at your watch and say, where's my cell phone? My wife bought me one because I'm always looking for my lost phone. I don't wear it yet because it's just an admission that I'm stupid and forgetful, and I don't want to do that. I'm not that old yet. Someone asked me, what's the problem with your church? I said, well, we got a lot of old people. I said, well, what's the problem with old people? I said, the problem with old people is that they keep getting older. That's the only problem. The rest of it's wonderful. But some of Carl Sagan's ideas have found their way into our society, into modern-day technology, and certainly into the textbooks and the minds of our youth. He has several famous quotes. One is, the idea that God is an oversized white male with a flowing beard who sits in the sky and tallies the fall of every sparrow is ludicrous. But if by God one means that the set of physical laws that govern the universe, then clearly there is such a God. This God is emotionally unsatisfying. It does not take much sense to pray to the law of gravity. He also said, if you accept the literal truth of every word of the Bible, then the earth must be flat. I don't think that's true. He also said some things about the Quran. But his most famous quote, and one that our youth are probably schooled on in their classes at school, is that your God is too small for my universe. So your God is too small for my universe. In other words, he's thinking bigger than God. The second most profound influencer of our time, I know we have a lot of influencers on things like TikTok and X and some of the other platforms that I don't know that much about. The few things I've seen, I know there's a lot of those memes they throw up now on YouTube and other places, so if I'm searching for the news, occasionally I'll come across some people that imitate, you know, whoever it is in politics, whatever. But before that, influencers were major philosophers, publishers, men of great education. The second one that I want to refer to today is Stephen Hawking. He was an English theoretical physicist and a cosmologist, also a studier of astronomy. He was the director of theoretical cosmology at the University of Cambridge. And, of course, he had a disease where he was kind of gradually losing all of his muscle control. He lived with that for 50 years. He was diagnosed at about age 21, motor neuron disease. But he achieved a lot of success with a number of books. His most popular book was called A Brief History of Time, where he tried to discuss everything from before the Big Bang, before things happened, all the way until the end of all things. And, of course, his basic premise was there is no God. This all happened entirely by accident. And those ideas are still being taught today in our schools. One of his famous quotes from Stephen Hawking, and he was a very brilliant physicist, just shows that a great mind without the controls of the truth of God can go off the rails very quickly. He said, it is my view that the simplest explanation that there is no God, no one created the universe, and no one directs our fate. This leads me to a profound realization. There is probably no heaven, no afterlife either. We live in this one life to appreciate the grand design of the universe. And for that, I am extremely grateful. So he's quoted as saying that. I think that was his final sort of statement before he died. But we have then these great philosophers that agree there is no God, therefore it is in our school systems, it is in our government, it is in the minds of many people, and the precipitous fall off from church attendance and interest in religious things around the world is one result of that. Now the third, you might say, foundational teacher of our time is a man named Richard Dawkins. He's well known for his criticism of creationism and intelligent design. He's a very vocal and widely publicized atheist. He's been in a number of TV programs and specials about him. He wrote The Blind Watchmaker, in which he says that just because things are complex, they can be happening by accident. I don't think he really understands that, obviously. But his second book, and the most profound book he wrote as far as having an impact, is called The God Delusion, where he takes on every argument for God and in his own mind and wordings tries to prove those things wrong. So those three people were those three foundational teachers would be like the Rousseau and the Montesquieu of the French Revolution, only they are for our time. If you wonder how did we become an almost atheistic nation, you know, that's the answer. We have these great teachers that we have followed, or at least accepted. And when it comes to societal degradation and what has happened to our families, what has happened to the structures that God designed, there are also several women who have been very influential. The first was Margaret Sanger. She was a birth control and activist of not having children, you might say. She founded the Planned Parenthood Association way back in the, I think, 1930s. She wrote a number of books. She sanctioned birth control, and she established the first abortion clinics in the country. Interesting that she did it in downtown, largely black areas of big cities. And she was a very firm eugenicist, and she was trying to, I think, focus that direction. So for that reason, she's come under a great deal of criticism, but still she had her Planned Parenthood organization, which she founded, has gone a long way to do a lot of societal damage to our country. We could add to that other names besides Margaret Sanger. We could add Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique, basically saying that women needed to get out of the house, they needed to not have kids, they needed to have their own career, they needed to reject men and take off on their own. And then, of course, people like Anne, who was the lady that said that men, women need men like fish need bicycles. I forgot her name. Gloria Steinem, right. Yeah, so where's our conscience, our walking encyclopedia today? Maybe Vidal's okay. I need him sometimes, and I miss him when he's not here to keep me on the straight and narrow. So we have these great philosophers who have caused the nations to rage. Why do we have such non-scientific and damaging philosophies as the transgenderism rage and so many other things that have taken hold on our country? I think it's something to sort of laugh about what's happened here locally, where they finally have realized after 3 years of chaos and destruction that legalizing all drugs in the streets of Portland has been a big mistake. What's sad is they're not really enforcing the new laws. They've made these new laws, but however, there's all these outs. You know, it's kind of like getting a traffic ticket you don't have to show up for. So until they actually start enforcing the laws, we're going to see a repeat of the terrible damage that's happened in the last 3 years. Let's go over to Isaiah chapter 5. Leave your marker there in Psalm chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 5. This is kind of a reflection where God talks about the excesses of the times in which Isaiah lived in the 800s BC. But it is a mirror into what's happening in our society. It might be a good illustration. This chapter might be a good illustration of what happens when people imagine vain things. And it begins with the beginning of Israel and what God did for them in creating them a nation and how they have abandoned that history, abandoned that knowledge. You know, God wants us to remember our roots, remember where we came from. How many psalms are about Israel coming out of Egypt? We sing those. When Israel out of... It's the hardest song in the hymnal to direct as a song leader. You can go, when Israel out, or you can go, when Israel out of Egypt. When... So there's no way to lead that song. They always played that trick on us when I was at college. Oh, I want you to lead a song. Okay, and then they would give us that one, and it was, you know, it just made you feel bad because you couldn't do it. And there are some guys who are good at it, I'm sure. But how many psalms are about that subject? When Israel out of Egypt went, remember coming out of Egypt and the manna God fed us with and brought us into these nations and destroyed King of Bashan and the others who were standing in our way. Well, Israel forgot that. So here in Isaiah 5, Isaiah is remembering that. Now let me sing to my well-beloved, a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard. The vineyard, of course, was Israel. On a very fruitful hill, he dug it up and cleared out his stones, planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower, protection in its midst, made a wine press in it. So he expected to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth corrupt or wild grapes. Now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge please between me and my vineyard. God says, what more could have been done to my vineyard? I think we could identify with this. What more could God have done for the descendants of Ephraim in this great nation, starting 250 or so or 280 years ago, where we've had protections, we've had oceans on both sides, for the most part friendly neighbors to the north and south, certainly not threatening neighbors. We've been given, as Abraham Lincoln said, the choicest piece of planet Earth. It was wonderful and abundant farmland, and we've been given everything, just like ancient Israel was given everything. But we have turned against it and produced wild grapes, just like our forefathers did. Verse 5 says, now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, that's a protection. It shall be burned and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. We no longer have a southern border. That wall has been taken down, and the invaders have come in by the millions. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug. There shall not come up, or shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain in it. And so we are being cursed because ancient Israel set the pattern that we are following. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. Some translations indicate that is the fig plant. It's the fig tree. That's why Jesus Christ cursed the fig tree, because for 3 years he came looking for fruit in the nation of Judah and found none, but that's a different study. But he looked for justice, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry for help. So God looks for justice, but look what has happened in our legal systems. For righteousness. Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place. And we certainly have massive numbers of houses being attached to houses being attached to houses. And of course, we know what people living like ants eventually turns into. Where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land, in my hearing, the Lord of hosts, truly many houses shall be desolate. So he's simply saying there is a famine coming, there is a desolation coming. 10 acres of vineyard shall yield a very small one jar of olive oil or of olive or of grape juice. One omer of seed shall yield one ephah. So you plant more seed than you would harvest. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, they may follow intoxicating drink. This is telling them what has been happening to their nation. They have gotten engulfed in pleasure, engulfed in drink. The harp and the strings and the tambourine and the flute and wine are in their feasts. Verse 13, therefore my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Or really, no knowledge of their past. No knowledge of what is happening, what has happened and the happened to Israel and all their ancestors before them. Now in Psalm chapter 2, you've already read that, but in verse 2 it mentions the kings of the earth set themselves together against Jesus Christ when he returns. The rulers of the earth set themselves together. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 16 and verse 12. This may very well happen in our time, as we have the religions of the world trying to amalgamate together. Certainly some of those religious leaders are. This week I wrote a little article about Pope Francis and his, seems like in his final years, he's trying to be the ecumenical pope and reach out to historical enemies of the Catholic Church. And we will see where that works out, but certainly a lot of talk about ignoring doctrine and teaching and simply uniting under a desire to feel good, I suppose. But let's keep our minds open and be watching some of those developments. It's very difficult to find it in the American media, but certainly we can find it if we do some research in the news. Revelation 16 and verse 12, it simply says here, the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. The Euphrates, as you know, flows out of Turkey, flows down southeast into the Shatt al-Arab waterway, so it is a central river in modern-day Iraq. I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and the mouth of the false prophet. What do these spirits do? They are spirits of demons performing signs. They go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to battle that great day of God Almighty. So almost the same wording as the second verse of Psalm 2. The kings take counsel together, and they say, we are going to resist the returning God and Jesus Christ because we don't want to have his bonds or his rules over us. You know, God laughs at their insolence. Let's go over to Zechariah chapter 12, another good prophecy on this same topic. As we think about the millennium and the coming Feast of Tabernacles and all that it will portray, there is a huge battle and there's a great conflict that has to take place first. Otherwise, the nations will continue to make their plans in vain. And just like in the times of Noah, it is on their mind to only commit evil continually. And certainly the corrupt, immoral nature of the nations of Israel that were supposed to be the example of the world is coming to light. And we are seeing that and the result of it. Zechariah chapter 12 says, the burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord who stretches out the heavens, says to the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within it. So here is God who created the heavens, created the earth, and he formed man and the spirit of man within him. I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. Now, I know we are a non-profit organization, but if in fact there was some movement to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock and to rebuild the temple, it could easily happen. We could wake up one morning and there's bulldozers up there knocking everything down and all sorts of workers getting ready to rebuild some sort of a temple. Now, God never told the Jews to rebuild the temple, and so it wouldn't be from God doing it. But if that did happen, it would cause a worldwide conflict of all the Muslim nations around the earth would then send their armies and come against Jerusalem. So Jerusalem would be a very heavy stone for all peoples. That's going to happen. It has been happening, you might say, for the last 100 years, but it will certainly increase. All who would heave it away will surely be cut to pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it. Then he says, in that day, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength and the Lord of hosts their God. So this is probably transferring to a time a little bit later when the nations are coming against the earth, against Jerusalem, I mean, because Jesus Christ is landing there. And they can understand that this being from outer space, that our youth have been schooled in things like Harry Potter, Star Trek, all the other make-believe fantasy outer space type ideas, they'll probably think, hey, it's real. Sometimes our youth don't even, our kids can't even tell the difference between what's make-believe and what's real because they've been subject to so much science fiction. And there's some studies on that I could quote, but I don't have the information here with me. So the governors of Judah in this case are really on God's side. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the wood pile and a fiery torch in the sheaves. They shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right hand and the left. This could be after the saints have landed with Jesus Christ on the Mount of Olives, so we will see. Verse 8 says, in that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, and the angel of the Lord before them. It shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So just like God said in Psalm 2 that he would hold them in derision, he would laugh at them. In this case, he simply says, I'm going to destroy all those nations that come against Jerusalem. And that, of course, is where we are today. The nations are preparing to come against Jerusalem, and we have to understand that because of what has happened, there is a there's no choice except a rod of iron, except a rod of punishment. Let's go over to back to Psalm chapter 2, and I'm going to go down to verse 10 when he says, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. We wonder, why is that necessary? Why is it that they have their this need to be punished so severely? Why can't they just correct themselves very quickly? Well, the answer, of course, is that they have become corrigible. They have become determined to disobey God no matter what. In Psalm chapter 2 and verse 10, he says, now therefore be wise, O kings, be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice in trembling. Kiss, which means to honor, to acknowledge the authority of the Son. In other words, he'll be here, lest he be angry, and lest you perish in the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Then it ends much like Psalm 1, blessed are those who put their trust in him. So we have the admonition to the kings of the earth who are being told to be instructed, and now you'd better listen. It's an interesting sidelight here. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 6. A question has always been raised, or is raised when you read these verses, about why these supposedly high and mighty men of the earth react the way they do. He says in Revelation chapter 6, which of course is the opening of the seals, you have the third and fourth seal and all of these, the pale horse and those who are giving power over the earth to kill, the death horse. It says in verse 12, I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became as black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth. So great turmoil in the sky. There was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth. So the stars of heaven are falling as a fig tree drops its figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky recedes as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. So is that just a massive number of clouds and wind going across, or is there some sort of something like a scroll that is rolled up and we can see something else? I don't know. But I think it really is revealing that there are great punishments coming in this sixth seal. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, these are the men who have been organizing against the returning Jesus Christ. Every slave and every free man, they hid themselves in caves and the rocks of the mountains. Notice it doesn't just say hide ourselves from an avalanche or hide ourselves from the falling rocks. They said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. That means they've been warned. That means they've been told ahead of time, the Lamb, Jesus Christ, is returning. The Son of Man is coming back to the earth, and you are going to be punished. So is that warning given to them by the two witnesses? Well, we'll have to wait and see. But just hiding from that terrible destruction is one thing, but admitting it's coming from the Father God who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb who's returning to the earth tells us that they know. They have full knowledge their punishment is coming. It says, for the great day of his wrath has come. So they knew his wrath was coming. You wonder how much people really understand, despite what they say, despite their boasting words, despite their prating against God, they might know that their punishment is coming for what they are doing. So blessed are those who put their trust in him, not only in Psalm 1 individually, but in Psalm 2, as we live in these nations that are in defiance of God. And what a great blessing it is for us to go to keep his feast every year, because it is only through the knowledge of his feast that we understand his plan and can really put the prophecies of God in the place where they should be in understanding what's coming. Let's go over to 2 Timothy chapter 2. If we ask, what is the state of us? What is the state of where we are? That's one of those questions that that some of these great philosophers like Carl Sagan have written, you know, what is the state of us, or, you know, what is us? Well, the church is not a hospital. Some have said that it is. The church is not a social center. The church is not just a place to go visit and have nice potlucks. As enjoyable as that is, that's not what the purpose of the church is. The purpose of the church is to be an army barracks. We are an army for God. We are not just a bunch of people who like to eat, a bunch of people who like to talk. No, we like to eat and we like to talk. I remember talking to the pastor up at the Scappoose Church that we rented. Very, very nice of them to let us use that building and really helped us through those difficult times. But, you know, they had that CCTV cameras there. And so he said, well, we're going to be monitoring you the first few weeks, making sure you're abiding by all the rules. So we had about 100 people go to church up there. And so sure enough, I get this call on Monday morning. And he says, hate to tell you this, but on our cameras we saw that some of your people are not social distancing. I said, but these are church people. Social distancing is anathema to us. We don't do that. You know, we hug, we get close, we like each other. He said, yeah, you're right, and I know that, and you know that, and I wish it wasn't so, but our state board, state council, has asked us to make sure everybody, at least for the first few weeks, abides by those rules. So we had to have our own little sort of encouragement once in a while to abide by some of those things. But the truth of the matter is, as enjoyable as being social and fellowshipping is, it's not why we are here. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Jesus Christ. The things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will also be able to teach others. Our job is to teach the truth. You must therefore endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So God's people are soldiers. And the Church of God is an army barracks more than anything else. We have other functions, we do other things, but we are an army for God, and we are to be standing up for His truth and being example to the world and being preparing for the return of Jesus Christ, as Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 both tell us we should be doing. When we consider what God is doing, let's go down to here a little farther in 2 Timothy. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life. And sadly, getting too entangled with the affairs of this life often leads to spiritual neglect, which eventually leads to spiritual decline, which leads to spiritual shipwreck. So be careful how much we entangle ourselves with the affairs of this life. Notice that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. So God enlisted each one of us as a soldier, not just someone entangled with the affairs of this life. And also, if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. We don't enter God's kingdom our own way. We don't have our own separate way of obeying God. There are two ways. Psalm 1 told us that. We cannot have one foot partially in one and the other foot partially in the other. So if anyone competes in athletics, he must do it according to the rules. The hardworking farmer must first partake of the crops. So the one who works hard partakes of the crops that he grows. Consider what I say to you, and may the Lord give you understanding in all things. So consider what God is saying to us in these momentous verses. We're going to be keeping the feast. 5 weeks from today is the Day of Atonement. Then we'll be going to our various locations to keep God's Feast of Tabernacles. And we'll think about the wonderful truths that are contained in this Psalm 2, the summary of the history of nations and mankind, and realize there's a time coming when that great King of Kings will rule all the earth and bring peace and prosperity, and there will never again be a days of Noah or a time when people reject God.